This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Look, I hate to be the guy who says I told you so, but one day's turmoil does not a bear market make, y'all. We will do bonds today, some trade news too, and our steel company president gets on the phone with us from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 18th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We complete today our market reporting trifecta. Stocks on Tuesday, if you remember, currency yesterday, bonds on this Thursday, saving IMHO the best for last, because bonds, my friends, they help us see the future. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note has been falling the past week, not precipitously, but enough to notice. Investors are buying 10-year, sending the price up, thus driving down the interest rate, the yields those bonds pay, and giving us insights into what the market is thinking about the Fed, the president, and once again, the future. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reads the bond market tea leaves.
FOMO. It means fear of missing out. We get it when all our friends go out to dinner without us. You know who kind of also gets FOMO? Investors thinking about buying a 10-year Treasury bond. Joe Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute.
The reason is investors have a choice. They could buy this long-term bond with a fixed interest rate, or they could leave the money in an overnight account.
An overnight account where the returns change. They change according to interest rates set by the Federal Reserve. So that's the FOMO. If I lock up my money for 10 years, then what if I miss out on better returns that come with the Fed raising interest rates?
The most important thing in bond yields is what financial markets, investors think the Federal Reserve will do with interest rates over the life of the bond.
So if the yield on the 10-year note is falling, it means bond investors think the Fed's not going to raise rates aggressively or quickly. Why do they think that right now? Raman Srivastava is with Standish Mellon.
You've seen economic data in the U.S. disappoint across a number of different areas, retail sales, inflation, spending, manufacturing.
Oh, and one more thing, the reality show known as U.S. Politics.
That's also dampened, I think, some of the optimism around some of these new policies coming through.
Policies like tax reform that some hoped would promote growth and that now seem so far away.
You use the bond market as your litmus test to what's going to happen to economic growth. And the bond market is telling us economic growth is just going to be slow and low.
Marilyn Cohen with Envision Capital Management. There's one last thing driving the bond market besides fear of missing out. Just plain fear. Bonds are a safe place to put your money in a world that seems a little less safe. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
After a couple of fits and starts, the White House made it official today, sending formal notification to Congress, and one assumes Mexico and Canada as well, that it's going to open up the North American Free Trade Agreement for renegotiation. About time, says Susan Schwab. She was the U.S. Trade Representative in the George W. Bush administration.
NAFTA, by trade agreement standards, is an ancient trade agreement.
The letter to Congress from newly confirmed Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer says as much. The last time this thing was renegotiated was 25 years ago. Just think about the digital economy, for one example. But, says Susan Schwab, now at the University of Maryland, there's also this.
The key is, how is it renegotiated? Is it going to be improved or is it going to be messed up?
Matt Gold, he teaches international trade law at Fordham. He is reasonably confident, and not for nothing, he's up on the mechanisms of modern news transmission, too.
The news today that the administration is focused on a realistic modernization of NAFTA rather than a massive overhaul that could cost U.S. sectors export markets is worth retweeting.
Right. Scale of 1 to 10, though, we are still early days. Mark Mellitz is a professor of economics at Harvard.
It's pretty low. I would give it a 3 and wait and see what is going to be in the meat of these renegotiations.
It's going to be 90 days, by the way, before anybody sits down at any negotiating tables to start hashing this thing out. Little history quiz for you. Who was the first president to talk about the idea of NAFTA? By the way, we got that answer in a video on our website. It's marketplace.org. All right, moving on. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said something interesting today. Testifying in front of the Senate Banking Committee, Mnuchin said he and his boss believe they can push the economy to 3% GDP growth or higher with what he called, and this is a quote, historic reforms to taxes and regulation. Assuming you've been listening to the Trump team for a while now, you'll know regulatory reform almost uniformly means having fewer of them. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent her day looking into how much growth you might really get by cutting regulations.
Lots of politicians and economists talk about the benefits of reducing regulations. Patrick McLaughlin is an economist at the right-leaning Mercatus Center. He says regulations have reduced growth by almost 1 or even 2% over the years.
It's the effect of accumulation of regulation, something that's been occurring for many, many decades. It's a death by a million cuts effect rather than the one single cut.
But like so much here in Washington, there's a bit of a partisan divide on the issue.
So the blanket statement, the idea that deregulation helps growth, I think that's just totally false.
Josh Bivens is an economist with the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute.
There is no consensus about the generalized impact of deregulation on growth because regulations are an incredibly, you know, heterogeneous group of stuff.
Like safety requirements for baby strollers or how many forms a business has to fill to add another widget to their assembly line. Mark Goldwine is with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Anytime we do any kind of regulatory reform, we're going to face trade-offs. Some policies will get us more economic growth, but they'll make us less happy or less safe or less clean in other ways.
Like some environmental regulations that can cost a lot of money, but you get cleaner air. Regardless, any benefits of reduced regulations would probably take many years to turn into noticeable growth, longer than one president's administration. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you know what? I am actually going to be that guy. Told you so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Roger Ailes died this morning, as you might have heard. The founder and former CEO of Fox News was 77 years old. He was, according to more than a dozen women who've come forward, a serial sexual harasser and enabler of it in his company. He was also, through that company, a man who changed this country. Gabriel Sherman literally wrote the book on Ailes. It's called The Loudest Voice in the Room. Gabe, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Test my thesis. Roger Ailes changed this country.
Agree wholeheartedly. You know, Roger Ailes did more than any person of his generation to transform American politics into a contact sport. He coarsened the culture, he mainstreamed conspiracy theories, and he paved the ground for the election of Donald Trump, who harnessed all of those currents that Roger Ailes unleashed on the country over the last 40 years.
Part of his programming, his business genius, was that he put stuff on the air that was just flat cheaper, right? Opinion and commentary is cheaper than actual reported journalism.
Oh, without question. I mean, this was, again, one of Ailes' unique insights. Is there was a famous saying inside Fox News when Ailes launched the network in 1996 that, quote, people don't want to be informed, they want to feel informed. And so what Ailes did is he adopted all of the trappings of a news network, the anchor desk, the sets, the studios, but he basically shed all of the actual functions of journalism, which are bureaus, reporters out in the field, expensive things like that. And so you have two people in a studio commenting on the news, and the audience at home doesn't necessarily feel that they're actually getting anything less. So that was one of his unique business insights. It was just a cheaper product to make, and the profit margins on Fox are reflective of that. It generates more than $1 billion a year for 21st Century Fox, the parent company.
Before I came into the studio to talk to you, I went back and I listened to our interview when your book came out, and two things stuck in my mind. One was that you said Roger Ailes was a man of extraordinary charisma, but also who managed that place, who ran Fox News with an iron fist and managed by fear.
Yes, and I think, you know, the scandals of the last year and the flood of women who came forward to allege sexual harassment is a testament to that fear. You know, when I reported my book, I had heard stories of the sexual harassment, but just whispers. And I had two women courageously go on the record to talk about Ailes's unwanted sexual advances and the way he wielded his power to try to dominate women. But the full scale and scope did not become fully evident until Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit, you know, really broke the dam and the flood of allegations came forward. You know, we should point out Ailes, to his death, denied those allegations. But the scope and just the volume of the allegations, you know, really paint a picture of a man who used his power to try to exert his will over women.
And we should say those lawsuits continue even after Ailes' death, right?
Not only do the lawsuits continue, but the federal investigation that is currently underway in the Southern District of New York, federal prosecutors, as we speak, are subpoenaing documents and records to look at whether Ailes and Fox News broke laws in the way he ran Fox to serve his personal agenda, and also about the ways in which Ailes used Fox News' budget to fund his private investigators and smear campaigns and potentially illegal surveillance of journalists.
When you watch Fox News today, what do you see?
I see a network casting about for an identity. I see a network chasing its audience. You know, Roger Ailes' brilliance, whatever you think of his politics, was that he knew what the Republican audience wanted before they did. You know, in 2007, Roger Ailes identified and harnessed the forces that would become the Tea Party. He put Glenn Beck on the air, basically coinciding with Barack Obama's first inauguration in 2009, and Glenn Beck's audience exploded because that was where the country was at the moment. Now what I see is a network that is waiting for another visionary to come in who can give it an identity. And I don't think it's necessarily become, you know, more mainstream or liberal, but yeah. You need somebody who can harness all of the disparate personalities on Fox and come up with a cohesive message, and they don't have that right now.
Gabriel Sherman is national affairs editor at New York Magazine. His book about Roger Ailes came out a couple of years ago. We had him on the program to talk about it. It's called The Loudest Voice in the Room. Gabe, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Washington Post got its hands on what looks like President Trump's proposed budget for the Department of Education for next year. $10.5 billion is going to disappear from federal education initiatives, among them things like after-school programs for the poor, teacher training, and at the college level, work-study money and loan subsidies. Those last two and some others are going to make it harder for students in this country to afford. College Marketplace's Adam Allington has that one.
If the president's education budget becomes reality, federal supplemental educational opportunity grants would be eliminated. Also, undergrads receiving subsidized loans would have to cover interest while they're still in school, and the billion-dollar federal work-study budget would be cut in half.
I think it's really hard to find a problem with federal work-study.
Justin Drager is the president of the National Association of Federal Student Aid Administrators. In previous years, he says Republicans have actually championed work study.
It's a self-help aid program, meaning it's not a grant. It's a program that gives students money for work.
But Jason Delisle of the American Enterprise Institute says students can still seek out jobs without a government grant to pay their salary.
And there's also nothing to stop a university from employing the student. All of those things can happen without a complicated, opaque government program.
Delisle also criticizes the work-study program for funding jobs at primarily elite schools. Adam Kufalt received $5,000 per year in work-study assistance to work in the dean's office at UC Berkeley.
So my job was to answer the phone, work around the office, help organize mail.
Kufalt says the fact that Berkeley is an elite school didn't change the fact that he needed the money to make ends meet.
In reality, that was my food. That was part of my rent.
Federal work-study funds jobs for roughly 700,000 undergraduate and graduate students nationally. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
coming up.
Pothole patching, vacant lot cleanup. It could be more tree pruning, you know, street cleaning.
Ah, the things you can do when you're not emptying trash cans. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials climbed 56 points today, about 0.2%, 20,663. NASDAQ up 43 points at a 0.7%, 6,055. S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.3%, closed at 2,365. Walmart shares hit a 52-week high today after the retailer shocked analysts with unexpectedly strong earnings. Digital sales alone climbed 63% in the quarter. Walmart up 0.3% today. Target added 1.4%. Amazon up about 1.4% as well. A number of top executives are going to accompany President Trump on his trip to Saudi Arabia and the Middle East and Europe this weekend. Among them, JPMorgan Chase's Jamie Dimon, Michael Corbett of Citigroup, James Gorman of Morgan Stanley. Here are the numbers. Chase off 0.75% today. Citi up 0.1%. Morgan Stanley banked 0.8%. You are listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. President Trump's economic surrogates were out and about today. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross on TV. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin on Capitol Hill, as I mentioned, talking up the administration's plans for trade renegotiation and tax reform. Ambitious would-be changes to the American economy that are being waylaid by American politics. So while we wait on some policy clarity, we've called up one of our regulars to see what it's like running a business right now. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company in Pennsylvania. Lisa, good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you as well.
We had you on right after the inauguration. 25th of January is when we talked to you. Here we sit, middle of May. Lots obviously happening. When we talked to you last time, you basically said, listen, the election's over. Let's get back to work. How you feeling now?
I think it's time to get back to work. I think that I've never experienced so many distractions personally. I think that it's kind of exhausted the American public. And with the news of an independent prosecutor, I think that it's very good news for everyone. I think that the president can get back to or begin to govern. I think he has some really good ideas. And with his group getting out of the day-to-day drama, they may or hopefully will begin to govern.
Have you seen in your business doings signs of the chaos? I mean, has it been affecting you?
Not really. I think that the economy's up, that people are spending more money, that steel is strong, our numbers look stellar, and I think it's going to continue to do so. There's some summer softening in the market, but that's all kind of as expected. It has nothing to do with the White House, at least for right now.
What do you most want Congress and the president to get done economically?
We have lots of agreement across party lines. The Democrats have wanted infrastructure bills for how long? So I think that we have common goals, how you get there, some important differences. But if we're able to get out of the drama and into the governance, I do think there's some commonality.
Are you timing agnostic? You just want a sense of motion toward these goals, right? With the understanding that some of the chaos is going to linger and politics will get in the way to some degree.
Politics seems to be getting in. It's like the fly in the ointment. We've been infested by flies. It's time to get things rolling. So you and I have spoken before about the idea of infrastructure and how exciting, and but that the timing of that, it's very not American. Americans want things now. And I was speaking with some of the group that worked on the Tappan Zee Bridge, both the creation and all of the infrastructure, just at dinner last night. And that bridge, the initial talks started in 2008. It won't be completed optimistically by late 18, probably further 19, and some numbers are even looking a little longer. And that's not a criticism, that's reality. So, yeah, we better get started on infrastructure now, or our grandchildren won't even begin to see it.
You know, it's interesting. You and I have talked several times, many times over the past, I don't even know, 2.5, 3, 4 years. And you have always come across as a pragmatist and a realist and sometimes, you know, with a negative tone to it. Right. Now you seem pragmatically optimistic, if that makes any sense.
Well, I'm often called an optimistic cynic. So,
okay.
And I think it's true. I'm heartened that I think the special prosecutor has freed us up. I kind of feel like the kids, the toys have been taken away from all the children, the very naughty children, and now everybody can get back to work. It's time to go do your homework and do what you were hired to do. I'm so disappointed in much of the media. They do a really good job getting the word out, but then they belabor the word.
Yeah.
Just to hear themselves speak. So it's really good to get the word out and then move on. So I want to take away some of these distracting toys and get back to work.
Lisa Goldenberg, the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
Terrific. Thanks, Kai.
Not all kinds of high-tech gizmos are the cool, fun, glitzy kind of high-tech gizmos, you know. Case in point, garbage cans. The public kind that you find in parks and on sidewalks. They need to be tended, emptied on a regular basis, which takes time and money and people. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Erica Barris reports on how that city is trying to cut down on workers' wasted hours.
It's a Monday morning, and I'm riding around in a Department of Public Works truck. We're slowly making our way along downtown streets, stopping to check public trash cans. About half need emptying. The rest, we skip. But Val Trincala and his coworkers still check every can on every street on their route.
I'm going to make a left here, and we're going to do Smithville, okay? Then we're going to do Boulevard Alleys.
This time next year, a ride with these guys will look pretty different. Pittsburgh is spending $854,000 to install sensors in street-side trash cans. Those sensors will transmit information that tells workers when the cans are full to reduce time they spend checking empty cans. Mike Gable is the director of Public Works.
If we are able to knock off 50,000 hours, that's roughly 25 employees that can be rededicated to other tasks in Public Works.
Things like
pothole patching, vacant lot cleanup. It could be more tree pruning, you know, street cleaning.
Gable expects this upfront money will turn into savings down the line. Sarah Bixby is with the Solid Waste Association of North America. She's seen variations of this type of technology in trash.
It adds better data to their decision making. And if we want to have more effective government or more effective collection programs, then you need better data.
It's what's called the Internet of Things, merging the physical with data to collect information. Carlo Ratti with the Sensible City Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology says this information can make cities run better. In Cambridge, his lab installed sensors on trash trucks.
By actually using just a small number of trucks, what you can do is very quickly learn a lot of things about the city. It's about air quality, it's about temperature, it's about potholes, infrastructure, and so on and so on.
He points to similar projects in Copenhagen and Singapore.
I would say we're at the beginning of this Internet of Things revolution in cities. And I think we need to experiment a lot.
That's going to be tough.
Back in the Department of Public Works truck, Val Trinkala, who's in the Teamsters union, says this experiment will waste tax dollars.
There's no need to get sensors and invest all that money to tell us what we're doing right now. That's not a good business decision.
He's been emptying cans for 37 years. Even if they're not full, he says they should still be emptied at least once a day. Food waste attracts rats. And the biggest concern? Discarded needles.
I believe if we don't check the way we check the cans, it'll be a hazard for the public.
While city officials expect a return on their investment within a few years, workers like Trinkala feel differently. At the dumping site, he points to a pile of dented, rusted trash receptacles. Snow, ice, salt, vandalism, those are the realities of street cans, he says. Not fancy cans with sensors that cost $1,200 a piece.
They're going to be scrapped in 3 years. Just by the weather, environment, by age. Everything gets old, things need repaired.
The sensors will be installed throughout the city over the next year. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am truly loath to spoil everybody's Thursday afternoon, but Bloomberg News has made a disturbing discovery. Seems House Speaker Paul Ryan hasn't sent the health care bill that his party passed a couple of weeks ago, which I know seems way longer ago, by the way, but it was really only May the 4th. Anyway, Ryan hasn't officially sent that bill to the Senate because he is waiting on the score from the Congressional Budget Office. And get this, depending on how that CBO score turns out, the House might have to vote on that bill again. It is still a hypothetical, but come on, the way this year's been going so far. All right, we're going. That's it. That's all we got. The Dow up 56 points today, 0.2%. NASDAQ up 43 points, about 0.7%. S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.3%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, for the time being, John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.